Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 3rd Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Legislature. Officials want to filter water. There's a desire to use federal money to get lead out of drinking water in schools and child care centers, by Conrad Swanson. Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park. DA won't file charges in death of six-year-old, by Taylor Shaw. Rivers in Colorado. A fight for public access rights. Fisherman 80 notches victory in legal battle against AG and landowners, by Bruce Finley. Ukraine. Biden orders troops to Europe amid stalled talks, by Robert Burns, Lolita C. Baldor, Amer Madhani, Lauren Cook, and Dasha Lidvinova. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Legislature. Officials want to filter water. There's a desire to use federal money to get lead out of drinking water in schools and child care centers, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Colorado lawmakers want to use millions of dollars of federal money to filter lead out of drinking water in schools and child care centers, not just in Denver, where the problem has been highly publicized, but all across the state. Money from the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan and the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill enacted last year could be used to install safe drinking stations and filters in each of Colorado's public schools and its child care centers, State Senator Rhonda Fields, Democrat of Aurora, said. We need to make sure every kid has access to safe drinking water, Fields said, and we need to do what we can to make sure we're filtering that lead out. The upcoming legislation, dubbed the Get the Lead Out of School Drinking Water Act, is the most affordable and immediate way to remove the heavy metal from drinking water in schools, according to Corey Bell, healthy and affordable water advocate at the Natural Resources Defense Council. The other option is to test and chase, Bell said, meaning test each school's water and replace their piping, which would be time-consuming and expensive. Providing filters for every school would negate the need for testing. Plus, most schools past a certain age likely have lead piping anyway, Bell said. While Denver banned the use of lead lines in 1971, other cities did not. The federal government didn't ban use of the heavy metal until 1986, and even then it still allowed lower levels in piping until 2014, she said. If you have a school that was built before 1986, it likely has lead plumbing, she said. Of 67 Colorado schools that tested their water between 2018 and 2020, 40 had lead levels above federal standards. For nearly $27 million, the state could install filtration systems in schools and child care facilities across the state, Bell said. Larger schools would receive one standalone hydration station for students to fill their water bottles for every 100 students. They'd also receive at least 5 point-of-use filters, which attach directly to faucets to ensure water used for cooking was also filtered. Smaller schools with fewer than 50 students would receive one point-of-use filter for every 10 students, Bell said. After the installation, the program would cost nearly $13 million annually to replace filters and test each school's drinking water twice a year, Bell said. In Denver alone, water for up to 84,000 homes flows through pipes with lead solder or lead service lines. Denver Water is moving fast to replace those lines, but its $500 million undertaking isn't expected to be finished until well into the next decade. Data collected by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment estimates that about 1.8% of children ages 6 and younger within Denver Water's coverage tested positive for elevated blood levels between 2017 and 2021. That's lower than the statewide average of 2% and the national average of 2.1%. But there's a catch. Doctors only test a fraction of children statewide for levels of lead in their blood, despite federal requirements for more widespread testing. That gap means state and local officials can't make any broad assumptions about how widespread the problem might be. In addition, that data shows elevated blood lead levels, but doctors say the heavy metal is unsafe in any quantity. One study, published in September, estimated that 72% of Colorado children ages younger than 6 had detectable levels of lead in their blood. The problem with lead piping, service lines, and solder is that particles of the heavy metal break off in the drinking water. People who drink that contaminated water store it in their bones, blood, and other tissues. Symptoms of lead exposure include constipation, headache, irritability, loss of appetite, and fatigue. The metal can also damage the nervous system, leading to memory loss and brain damage. In cases of high exposure, it can kill. Still developing children are particularly susceptible to exposure. The legislation hasn't yet been formally proposed, but State Senator Faith Winter, Democrat of Westminster, said during a news conference Monday that the time is right to capitalize on federal dollars set aside specifically to replace lead infrastructure. "This is the year to get this done," Winter said. Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park. DA won't file charges in death of six-year-old, by Taylor Shaw, the Denver Post. Prosecutors will not file any criminal charges in connection with the death last year of the six-year-old girl who fell from a ride at Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park, saying they lack the evidence needed to prove park employees acted negligently or recklessly. Ninth Judicial District Attorney Jefferson Cheney wrote in a January 25th letter released by his office Wednesday that he weighed charges of criminally negligent homicide and manslaughter in the September 5th death of Wangel Estefanos at the Glenwood Springs Amusement Park. "After considering all of the information provided to me, I conclude that the Office of the District Attorney cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt any one person or entity acted with criminal negligence or was criminally reckless beyond a reasonable doubt," Cheney wrote. Wangel, who wasn't buckled in, died after falling more than 100 feet from her seat on the Haunted Mine Drop ride. State investigators found that two ride operators did not properly check her seatbelt. She was sitting on top of it and ignored an alarm that should have alerted them to the safety issue. The state investigation found inadequate training and multiple errors made by the ride operators contributed to Wangel's death. The Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety, which licenses amusement rides, fined the park's owners $68,000 in October. The girl's parents released a statement Wednesday highly critical of Cheney's decision, saying the lack of criminal charges means our daughter's life has been treated as cheap and meaningless. "We never wanted the people who killed our daughter to go to jail," Estefanos Dagmi and Rahel Estefanos said in a statement released by their attorney, Dan Kaplis. "But for the DA to let them off with nothing says our daughter's life was worth nothing." The parents said Cheney sent the message that in Glenwood Springs, someone can recklessly kill a child and not even get a ticket. The Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park released a statement Wednesday, emphasizing its priority on safety, but noting one accident is one too many, and we are taking steps to be sure that nothing like that can ever happen again. "We continue to offer our condolences to the Estefanos family," said Steve Beckley, the amusement park's founder. "I am so sorry for their loss, and while I understand that my words cannot touch their grief, my heart continues to ache for them." Though nobody associated with the park will face criminal charges, the circumstances surrounding Wangel's death will be litigated in court. Her parents filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the park in October, alleging that a pattern of recklessness and improper training caused their daughter's death. The criminal system failed our daughter. We will now go to civil court and prove it on our own, Wangle's parents said in their statement Wednesday. Wangle and her family had visited the amusement park over Labor Day weekend as part of their vacation from Colorado Springs. Wangle boarded the Haunted Mine Drop, a six-person ride that features a 110-foot drop into a tunnel with her uncle and a few relatives, according to the lawsuit. The two ride operators, who had been hired a few weeks prior, did not realize Wangle was sitting on top of her seatbelt. When an alarm went off alerting the issue, the operators reset the system to bypass the alarm and start the ride, state investigators found. The family's lawsuit also claimed the park was warned about lax seatbelt checks twice before Wangle's death. In 2018, a mother emailed the park and claimed that operators didn't realize a teenager was not belted in and had to be told by shouting passengers about the issue before it was fixed. Another passenger sent an email in 2019 stating he inadvertently sat on top of the seatbelt on the ride and had to be persistent in convincing the ride operator he was not buckled in. "We want justice for our daughter," Wangle's parents said. "We want to protect others." The Associated Press contributed to this report. Rivers in Colorado, a fight for public access rights. Fisherman, 80, notches victory in legal battle against AG and landowners by Bruce Finley, the Denver Post. Colorado's Court of Appeals has cleared the way for 80-year-old fisherman Roger Hill to fight for his right to fish in peace on his favorite stretch of the Arkansas River as it flows down from snow-packed mountains. This court ruling also means any other Colorado resident who has been forced off a river from the Animas to the Yampa can go to court to protect public access. A three-judge panel unanimously rejected the position of Colorado's government, which sided with landowners against Hill. Colorado allows private ownership of riverbeds, while all other states treat rivers deemed navigable as public. "I just like to get out on a clear stream, and I enjoy watching the fish," Hill said from his home in Colorado Springs, delighted at the decision in what he describes as a decade-long life mission. "We're going to get a chance to establish this as the law of Colorado, the freedom to wade in rivers, whether you fish or not, the freedom to have your feet on the bottom of a river," he said. "It could open access to waters I am dying to fish if I live long enough." Back in August 2012, Mark Warsawa and Linda Joseph, owners of land adjacent to the Arkansas, ordered Hill off the river as he was catch-and-release fishing about 5 miles downstream from Cotopaxi, where Texas Creek flows in and brown trout abound, along with occasional rainbows, court records show. Hill's initial complaint alleges Joseph threw basketball-sized rocks down on him to drive him away. The appeals judge's January 27th ruling says state courts must decide river access cases depending on how rivers were used in 1876 when Colorado became a state. That's the navigability at statehood test, based on whether rivers could be used commercially in their ordinary condition that the U.S. Supreme Court set for states in determining whether a riverbed can be private property. In Hill's case, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser contends only state authorities, not residents, can fight in court for public access to rivers. Weiser wrote in a July 21, 2021 letter to a concerned southwestern Colorado resident that allowing residents to press claims in court would destabilize property rights throughout the state and jeopardize partnerships state officials have negotiated with landowners that allow limited public access for fishing. Weiser this week declined to comment on the appeals court ruling. "We're reviewing the opinion and will determine next steps," AG spokesman Lawrence Pacheco said. State officials and the landowners still could petition the Colorado Supreme Court before March 10th, seeking a review. For years, the matter of public access to rivers periodically has reached courts, including disputes over rafting on the Gunnison and Taylor Rivers in western Colorado and kayaking on the South Platte through Cheeseman Gorge, southwest of Denver. No state laws or regulations define navigability. Hill in 2018 filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging Warsawa and Joseph after they forced him off the Arkansas River. Colorado's Attorney General at the time, Republican Cynthia Kaufman, joined the case backing the landowners. Since then, Hill and his attorneys, University of Colorado law professor Mark Squillis and Dillon-based attorney Alexander Hood, have fought in federal court and back to state court on procedural grounds, insisting that Hill should be able to be heard in a court. Colorado appeals judges in their decision wrote that if, as Hill alleges, the relevant segment of the river was navigable at statehood, then the Warsawa defendants do not own the riverbed and would have no right to exclude him from it by threats of physical violence or prosecution for trespass. Hill's case is based on historical evidence that the Arkansas below Leadville was used for commerce around the time Colorado became a state, specifically the transport of beaver pelts, logs, and railroad ties down the river. We certainly cannot, at this early stage, know whether Hill will be able to establish that the river segment was navigable at statehood, but we cannot say it is not plausible, the judges wrote. Hill now is preparing for a state district court trial in Fremont County to decide the factual case. There are private landowners who have set up private fishing clubs on rivers. They make good money allowing people to fish on their supposedly private riverbeds. They don't want the public to have the right to come in and fish on the rivers, Squillis said. Our state attorney general should be defending the public's right to use our rivers. Instead, our attorney general has been arguing there are no navigable rivers in Colorado, and that even if they were navigable, the attorney general essentially can deny public access rights. Hill is a retired physicist who works for defense contractors on nuclear missile development and in 1991 published a guidebook for fishing along the South Platte. Colorado Trout Unlimited and backcountry hunters and anglers have supported his stance. Meanwhile, the Colorado Water Congress, an association of water professionals, backs the state along with landowners who claim riverbeds as their private property. The appeals court has created the potential for a storm of litigation, said Steve Lionheart, a water attorney who filed the CWC's position in this case. It's a threat to property rights people have generally thought were settled for 150 years. Hill's case will turn on an intense factual battle over navigability in 1876, and floating logs and beaver pelts shouldn't be enough to satisfy the federal test, Lionheart said. Colorado doesn't have the kind of navigable waterways that other states do. For example, if people had to portage a stretch of a river at or before the time of statehood, that weighs against any finding of navigability. An attorney representing Warsawa didn't respond to requests for comment. Since 2006, Warsawa has owned land adjacent to the Arkansas and claimed ownership of the riverbed, court records show. Hill entered the river from public land nearby and waded to where it flows through the land. Whether or not Roger wins, the implications of this appeals court decision are vast. Now, anybody in the state who is being forced off a river by a private landowner can challenge that person in court. They can say, "You have no right to tell me I cannot be there because the river was navigable," Hood said. The public now has a lever to pull. As Colorado's population and outdoor recreation industry expand, future legal fights over access to rivers have emerged as a possibility. Governor Jared Polis could set up a process for efficiently determining which stretches of river were navigable at statehood, Squillis said. What this ruling means is that for the first time, Colorado courts will have to recognize that the public has access to all navigable streams in Colorado, and it would be crazy to have to go and litigate to establish the navigability of every river, he said. Let's set up a state commission and figure this out. Ukraine. Biden orders troops to Europe amid stalled talks. By Robert Burns, Lolita C. Baldor, Amir Madhani, Lauren Cook, and Dasha Litvinova, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden is ordering 2,000 U.S.-based troops to Poland and Germany and shifting 1,000 more from Germany to Romania, demonstrating to allies and foes America's commitment to NATO's eastern flank amid fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Pentagon said Wednesday. Russia fired back with a sharply worded objection, calling the deployments unfounded and destructive. Russian President Vladimir Putin also had a new telephone exchange with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but readouts from both governments showed no progress, with Putin saying the West was giving no ground on Russia's security concerns and Johnson expressing deep concern about Russia's hostile activity on the Ukrainian border, referring to Putin's buildup of 100,000 troops there. The Biden administration is aiming to demonstrate U.S. resolve without undermining efforts to find a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Biden notably has not sent military reinforcements to the three Baltic countries on NATO's eastern flank, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, that are former states of the Soviet Union. No U.S. troops are being sent to Ukraine, and White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on Wednesday said the administration has stopped calling a Russian invasion imminent because the word implies Washington knows Putin has made a decision to invade. Officials say Putin's intentions remain unclear. However, increasing U.S. troop levels in Eastern Europe is exactly what Putin has said he finds intolerable, along with the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO. The U.S. already has several thousand troops in Poland, and Romania is host to a NATO missile defense system that Russia considers a threat. The U.S. presence in the region has increased since 2014, when Russia made its first invasion of Ukraine. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said the soon-to-deploy U.S. forces are intended to bolster U.S. and allied defensive positions temporarily. These are not permanent moves, he said, stressing that the purpose is to reassure allies. Kirby said Russia had continued its buildup, even in the previous 24 hours, despite U.S. urgings that it de-escalate. In Moscow, a senior official said the U.S. movements will complicate the crisis. The unfounded destructive steps will only fuel military tensions and narrow the field for political decisions. Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Grushko said in remarks carried by the Interfax news agency. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba again played down fears of a Russian attack in a call with reporters, but said that if Russia makes moves that could signal an imminent invasion, Ukraine would react as necessary. Of the 2,000 U.S. troops newly deploying from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, about 1,700 are members of the 82nd Airborne Division Infantry Brigade, who will go to Poland. The other 300 are with the 18th Airborne Corps and will go to Germany, as what the Pentagon called a joint task force capable headquarters. Poland's defense minister, Mariusz Błaszczak, wrote on Twitter that the deployment to his country is a strong signal of solidarity in response to the situation in Ukraine. The 1,000 U.S. troops going to Romania are members of the 2nd Cavalry Regiment based at Vilsack, Germany. They will augment about 900 already in Romania, Kirby said. The cavalry deployment's purpose is to deter aggression and enhance our defensive capabilities in frontline allied states during this period of elevated risk, the Pentagon said in a separate written statement. It's important that we send a strong signal to Mr. Putin and to the world of the U.S. commitment to NATO, Kirby said. He said France has decided it, too, will send troop reinforcements to Romania under NATO command, and he noted that a number of other European NATO countries are considering adding forces on NATO's eastern flank. NATO has been beefing up its defenses around allies in Eastern Europe since last year. Denmark, for example, said it was sending a frigate and F-16 warplanes to Lithuania. And Spain was sending 4 fighter jets to Bulgaria and 3 ships to the Black Sea to join NATO naval forces. The Netherlands plans to send 2 F-35 fighter aircraft to Bulgaria in April and is putting a ship and land-based units on standby for NATO's Response Force. Biden has said he will not put American troops in Ukraine to fight any Russian incursion, although the United States is supplying Ukraine with weapons to defend itself and seeking to reassure allies in Eastern Europe that Washington will fulfill its treaty obligation to defend them in the event they are attacked. Ukraine is not a NATO member, and therefore the U.S. has no treaty obligation to come to its defense. The military moves come amid stalled talks with Russia over its buildup at Ukraine's borders, and they underscore growing fears across Europe that Russian President Putin is poised to invade Ukraine. Smaller NATO countries on the alliance's eastern flank worry they could be next. The Pentagon also has put about 8,500 U.S.-based troops on higher alert for possible deployment as additional reassurance to allies. The U.S. already has between 75,000 and 80,000 troops in Europe. Washington and Moscow have been at loggerheads over Ukraine, with little sign of a diplomatic path forward. However, Kirby on Wednesday confirmed the validity of a document reported by a Spanish newspaper that indicated the United States could be willing to enter into an agreement with Russia to ease tensions over missile deployments in Europe if Moscow steps back from the brink in Ukraine. The daily El País published two documents that Kirby confirmed were written replies from the United States and NATO last week to Russia's proposals for a new security arrangement in Europe. In reference to the second document, NATO said it never comments on alleged leaks, but the text closely reflects statements made to the media last week by NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg as he laid out the 30-nation military organization's position on Russia's demands. The U.S. document, marked as a confidential non-paper, said the United States would be willing to discuss in consultation with NATO partners a transparency mechanism to confirm the absences of Tomahawk cruise missiles at Aegis Airshore sites in Romania and Poland. That would happen on condition that Russia offers reciprocal transparency measures on two ground-launch missile bases of our choosing in Russia. Aegis Airshore is a system for defending against shorter intermediate-range missiles. Russia argues the site in Romania could be easily adapted to fire cruise missiles instead of interceptors, a claim that Washington has denied. Putin on Tuesday accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring Russia's central security demands, but said that Moscow is willing to keep talking. Russia invaded Georgia in 2008 and in 2014 annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and provided military support for a pro-Russian separatist movement in eastern Ukraine. About 14,000 people have been killed in the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Eastern European crisis. Ukrainians train in guerrilla tactics in case Russia invades, by Mstislav Chernov and Lori Hinnant, the Associated Press, byline, Kharkiv, Ukraine. The table tennis coach, the chaplain's wife, the dentist, and the firebrand nationalists have little in common except a desire to defend their hometown and a sometimes halting effort to speak Ukrainian instead of Russian. The situation in Kharkiv, just 25 miles from some of the tens of thousands of Russian troops massed at the border of Ukraine, feels particularly perilous. Ukraine's second-largest city is one of its industrial centers and includes two factories that restore old Soviet-era tanks or build new ones. It's also a city of fractures between Ukrainian speakers and those who stick with the Russian that dominated until recently, between those who enthusiastically volunteer to resist a Russian offensive and those who just want to live their lives. Which side wins in Kharkiv would well determine the fate of Ukraine. If Russia invades, some of Kharkiv's 1 million plus people say they stand ready to abandon their civilian lives and wage a guerrilla campaign against one of the world's greatest military powers. They expect many Ukrainians will do the same. This city has to be protected, said Victoria Balasina, who teaches table tennis to teenagers and dyes her cropped hair deep purple at the crown. We need to do something, not to panic and fall on our knees. We do not want this. Balasina recalls being pressured to attend pro-Russia rallies during the protest movement that swept Ukraine after Russia attacked in 2014, a year that utterly changed her life. A lifelong Russian speaker born and raised in Kharkiv, she switched to Ukrainian. Then she joined a group of a dozen or so women who meet weekly in an office building for community defense instruction. Now her Ukrainian is near fluent, although she still periodically grasps at words, and she can reload a machine gun almost comfortably. This wasn't the life she expected at age 55, but she's accepted it as necessary. Plenty of people in her social circle sympathize with Russia, but they're not what drives her today. "I am going to protect the city, not for those people, but for the women I'm training with," she said. Among her group is Svetlana Putelina, whose husband is a Muslim chaplain in the Ukrainian military. With grim determination and not a hint of panic, the 50-year-old has orchestrated emergency plans for her family and for her unit, who will take the children to safety outside the city, who will accompany older parents and grandparents to one of the hundreds of mapped bomb shelters. How will the resistance women deploy? "If it is possible and our government gives out weapons, we will take them and defend our city," said the mother of three and grandmother of three more. If not, she at least has one of her husband's service weapons at home, and she knows how to use it. Elsewhere in Kharkiv, Dr. Oleksandr DeKalo dragged two creaky exam chairs into a labyrinth basement and refilled yellow jerry cans with fresh water. The public dental clinic he runs is on the ground floor of a 16-story apartment building, and the warren of underground rooms is listed as an emergency shelter for the hundreds of residents. DeKalo knows how to handle weapons as well, from his days as a soldier in the Soviet Army when he was stationed in East Germany. His wife works as a doctor at Kharkiv's emergency hospital and regularly tends to Ukrainian soldiers wounded at the front. The conflict that began in Ukraine's Donbas region subsided into low-level trench warfare after agreements brokered by France and Germany. Most of the estimated 14,000 dead were killed in 2014 and 2015, but every month brings new casualties. "If, God forbid, something happens, we must stand and protect our city. We must stand hand to hand against the aggressor," DeKalo said. At 60, he's too old to join the civil defense units forming across the country, but he's ready to act to keep Kharkiv from falling. A guerrilla war fought by dentists, coaches, and housewives defending a hometown of 1,000 basement shelters would be a nightmare for Russian military planners, according to analysts and U.S. intelligence officials. The Russians want to destroy Ukraine's combat forces. They don't want to be in a position where they have to occupy ground, where they have to deal with civilians, where they have to deal with an insurgency, said James Scherer, an analyst of Russian military strategy, who testified last week before a British parliamentary committee. There are growing calls in Washington for the CIA and the Pentagon to support a potential Ukrainian insurgency. While Russia's forces are larger and more powerful than Ukraine's, an insurgency supported by U.S.-funded arms and training could deter a full-scale invasion. Polling of ordinary Ukrainians reviewed by intelligence agencies has strongly indicated there would be an active resistance in the event of an invasion, according to two people familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive information. A spokesperson for the U.S. Director of National Intelligence declined to comment. Russia denies having plans for an offensive, but it demands promises from NATO to keep Ukraine out of the alliance, halt the deployment of NATO weapons near Russian borders, and to roll back NATO forces from Eastern Europe. NATO and the U.S. call those demands impossible. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said recently that any escalation could hinge on Kharkiv. The city is also the base for Yevheny Muraev, identified by British intelligence as a person Russia was considering installing as president. "Kharkiv has over 1 million citizens," Zelensky told the Washington Post. "It is not going to be just an occupation. It's going to be the beginning of a large-scale war." That is precisely what Anton Dutsenko fears. At 18, he was front and center in the wave of protests that brought down the pro-Russia government in 2014. Now he's a 24-year-old tech worker, and he's had enough upheaval. When people are calm and prosperous and everything is fine, they don't dance very well. But when everything's bad, that's when they party hard, like it's the last time, Dutsenko said during a smoke break outside a pulsing Kharkiv nightclub. This is a stupid war, and I think this could all be resolved diplomatically. The last thing I would like to do is give my life, to give my valuable life, for something pointless. The young people dancing inside would say the same, he declared in Russian. If the war starts, everyone will run away. This is what one nationalist youth group hopes to prevent. They meet weekly in an abandoned construction site, masked and clad in black as they practice maneuvers. The men who join that group or the government-run units have shown themselves to be up for the challenge to come, said one of the trainers, who identified himself by the nom de guerre Pulsar. Kharkiv is my home, and as a native, the most important city for me to protect. Kharkiv is also a frontline city, which is economically and strategically important, he said, adding that many people in the city are ready to protect their own until the end, as are many Ukrainians. The same sentiment rings out among Ukrainians in the capital, Kyiv, and in the far west, in Lviv. Both our generation and our children are ready to defend themselves. This will not be an easy war, said Marina Tsuluko, a 40-year-old baker who signed up as a reservist with her 18-year-old daughter in Kyiv. Ukrainians have a rich tradition of guerrilla warfare. We don't want to fight Russians. It's the Russians who are fighting us. Biden Initiative, ambitious plan unveiled to have cancer death rate by Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Gina Collada, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden unveiled a plan Wednesday to reduce the death rate from cancer by at least 50% over the next 25 years. An ambitious new goal, he said, to supercharge the cancer moonshot program he initiated and presided over 5 years ago as vice president. Biden, joined by his wife, Jill, and Vice President Kamala Harris, also announced a campaign to urge Americans to undergo screenings that were missed during the pandemic. And he said he would create a new cancer cabinet to center the fight against cancer inside the White House. Let there be no doubt, the president declared during a White House ceremony attended by about 100 people, including patients, doctors, caregivers, researchers, and members of Congress. Now that I am president, this is a presidential White House priority, period. But despite the grand ambitions of the moonshot, cancer experts expressed doubt that it would be possible to reduce the age-adjusted death rate so profoundly, which accounts for expectations that older people are more likely to grow ill and die. More screenings are not the answer. The only cancers for which screening has indisputably lowered the death rate are colon and cervical. Death rates for other cancers, such as breast, have fallen. But a large part of the drop, if not all of it, is because of improved treatment, said Donald A. Berry, a biostatistician at the University of Texas who has spent decades studying these issues. Everybody loves early detection, but it comes with harms, he said. Principally, the harm of finding and treating tumors that do not need to be treated because they are innocuous. The harms we know, but the benefits of screening are very uncertain, he said. If the age-adjusted cancer death rate were to plunge by 50%, it would have to be because cancers were being cured. Some treatments, like a drug that treats chronic myelogenous leukemia, have slashed death rates for that disease, but such marked efforts in cancer are few and far between. The president has a deep personal interest in cancer research. In 2015, his son Beau died of glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer. The next year, President Barack Obama called on Biden in his State of the Union address to lead the Moonshot program, with the goal of making a decade's worth of advances in cancer prevention, diagnosis, and treatment in 5 years. At the time, Congress authorized $1.8 billion over 7 years. About $400 million of that money has yet to be allocated. The National Cancer Institute, which oversees the initiative, says it has spent $1 billion on more than 240 research projects. Senior administration officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, said Tuesday evening that the White House would not be announcing any new funding commitments, but insisted that there would be robust funding. Biden called on Congress to appropriate money to create a health research initiative modeled on the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA. The White House billed the event as a fresh push by the president to reignite the moonshot program and end cancer as we know it. Specifically, Biden set a goal of cutting the age-adjusted death rate by more than half over the next 25 years, but there were few specifics about how that goal would be achieved. These are audacious goals, and I have no doubt there will be mechanisms to achieve them, said Ellen V. Siegel, the founder of Friends of Cancer Research, which works to support cancer research and deliver new therapies to patients, who was briefed on the plan. Biden has named Danielle Carnival, who worked on the Moonshot program during the Obama administration, to help oversee the new version of the effort. Now, the president said, the Cancer Cabinet will coordinate the work of multiple government agencies. The White House says more than 9.5 million cancer screenings were missed in the United States as a result of the pandemic. Biden is calling on the Cancer Institute, a branch of the National Institutes of Health, to coordinate the cancer treatment centers to offer screenings around the country and to develop a program to fast-track the development of tests that can detect multiple types of cancer at once. One Wall Street analyst who specializes in biotechnology and pharmaceuticals said that the time, money, and effort might be better spent on initiatives to prevent cancer, like reducing smoking and rates of obesity. Presidents since Richard Nixon have sought to tackle cancer, of which there are more than 100 types of disease that can vary in how they grow, spread, and respond to treatment. The Cancer Institute estimates that nearly 40% of men and women will be diagnosed with some type of cancer at some point during their lifetimes. The American Cancer Society estimates there will be 1.9 million new cases of cancer in the United States this year and more than 609,000 cancer deaths. In news briefs, CNN president resigns after relationship with coworker, Byline, New York. CNN president Jeff Zucker abruptly resigned Wednesday after acknowledging a consensual relationship with another network executive, an entanglement that came to light during an investigation of now-fired anchor Chris Cuomo. Zucker said he was asked about his relationship with longtime aide Allison Gullust as part of the Cuomo investigation, which revealed that the former anchor had aided his brother, then New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, as he navigated a sexual harassment scandal. I acknowledge the relationship that had evolved in recent years, Zucker wrote in a memo announcing the end of his 9-year tenure. I was required to disclose it when it began, but I didn't. I was wrong. 12 migrants freeze to death, stripped by Greek guards, Turkey says. Byline, Istanbul. 12 migrants died Wednesday in Turkey, most of them found with little clothing in a freezing field near the border with Greece, according to several Turkish officials. The Greek migration minister, Notis Mitarachi, said the deaths were a tragedy but denied the Turkish accusations, calling them false propaganda. Turkey has always denied pushing migrants back after they have crossed from Turkey, even after the United Nations documented such cases. At least 60 dead in attack on camp for displaced people in Congo. Byline, Kinshasa. At least 60 people were killed after militants attacked a camp housing people displaced by violence in the eastern Congo, officials and a monitoring group said Wednesday, in one of the biggest assaults to hit the restive region in almost a year. Militants attacked the Plain Savo camp in Ituri province Tuesday night with guns and machetes, killing 60 people, said Ndalo Boots, who works for Caritas Congo and manages the camp. More than 50 people were injured, some severely, Boots said. Those killed included at least 16 children and 9 women, according to Pierre Beausoleil, the coordinator of the Kivu Security Tracker, which records violence and human rights violations in eastern Congo. Panel says some Havana syndrome cases may stem from radio energy. Byline, Washington. A panel of experts assembled by the Biden administration concluded Wednesday that stress or psychosomatic reactions could not explain some of the incidents of Havana syndrome they had reviewed, and it said that radio waves could have caused some of the injuries among CIA officers and diplomats. The panel, which included government scientists and outside experts, did not try to determine who was responsible for the incidents. And officials said the conclusions did not contradict interim findings by the CIA that unexplained incidents were not the result of a sustained global campaign by Russia or another adversary. But there are tensions between the panel's work and the CIA's conclusions. The panel's findings could bolster the arguments of victims and lawmakers who believe a hostile foreign nation could have caused at least some of the injuries. Four charged after overdose death of actor Michael K. Williams, Byline, New York. Four men faced charges that they were members of the drug distribution crew that supplied a deadly mix of drugs to Michael K. Williams, the renowned actor from The Wire, who overdosed just hours after buying fentanyl-laced heroin in a sidewalk deal recorded on surveillance video. All four were arrested Tuesday and are accused of distributing fentanyl-laced heroin of a kind that caused the death of Williams, who gained fame playing Omar Little on the HBO series that portrayed drug crews like the ones authorities say the four defendants belong to. These reports were from Denver Post Wire Services. Doug Coe has to cancel classes. Staff plans protest. Douglas County School District canceled classes for Thursday as hundreds of teachers and other staff members are calling off work in protest of recent actions by the school board. District buildings will be open for a staff and teacher workday. Activities such as sports will still take place Thursday, but students should not report for school, spokeswoman Paula Hands said Wednesday. Kevin DePasquale, president of the Douglas County Federation, previously said he heard more than 900 substitutes had been requested for Thursday. Douglas County School District has more than 8,000 employees, including 3,400 classroom teachers. The protest, which includes a rally at 1 p.m. at the district's administration building in Castle Rock Thursday, follows allegations made by three members of the district's Board of Education that other board members are trying to oust Superintendent Corey Wise. The board also recently voted to change the district's equity policy, DePasquale said. As of Wednesday afternoon, Wise has not resigned, Hans said. This was from Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Denver Deputy Fire Chief steps down after DUI traffic stop. The deputy chief of the Denver Fire Department was pulled over in Nevada last weekend in a driving under the influence traffic stop. Jeremy Vigil, on Monday, resigned from his role as deputy chief, the second highest position in the department, with more than 1,000 employees. Some actions and decisions I made over the weekend are not in alignment with the visions and values of our organization, Vigil said in a memorandum provided by the department. Vigil is second in command to Chief Desmond Fulton. Vigil was driving a department vehicle when he was stopped, said Captain Greg Pixley, a department spokesman. This report was by Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. Proposed policy targets affordability. In Denver, new housing developments would have to set aside some units for lower-income tenants. By Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Denver officials on Wednesday unveiled a proposed affordable housing policy that, if adopted, would mandate new residential projects for the city set aside at least 8% of their condos or apartments as income-restricted housing for 99 years. The proposal is the latest and one of the most ambitious in the city's efforts to push back on its housing crisis. It was made possible when the legislature last year empowered local governments to set affordability mandates through House Bill 21-1117. Anyone who has been in Denver for some time can tell you how difficult it can be to find a place that's affordable, especially if your income has not increased as much as rents and home prices have over the past decade, Denver Community Planning and Development Director Laura Aldrete said in a statement accompanying the draft policy on Wednesday. As outlined in a summary document, the policy would apply to all new housing developments of 10 or more in the city. The number of units the city would require be set aside as income-adjusted affordable housing would range from 8% to 15%, depending on factors including where a project is and what level of affordability it would provide. For example, an apartment building being built in an area deemed a high-cost market, such as downtown, would be required to set aside 15% of its units as affordable if rents will be capped at a level accessible to people making 70% of the area median income. A for-sale condo project being built in a typical market in town would need to set aside 8% of its units as affordable if the developer prices them at a level that is attainable to people making 80% of the area median income. The area median income for Denver this year is $84,000 for a two-person household, city officials said in a news release. Meeting the requirements of the policy would trigger incentives including decreased permit fees and low parking space requirements. Developers, in accordance with state law, would still have the option to buy their way out of the mandate or strike another agreement, such as providing land for future affordable housing construction, to avoid providing the income-restricted apartments or condos in their projects. The cost of providing cash in lieu of affordable housing would range from $250,000 to $478,000, depending on the project, according to the city's summary. Beyond requirements for affordable housing and new projects, the draft proposal also outlines a steady increase in the city's linkage fee. The fee, which feeds the city's affordable housing fund, would apply only to commercial development and residential projects of 9 or fewer units. It would more than double for all kinds of construction until July 1, 2024, under the proposed policy. Members of the public are being asked to offer feedback on the proposal until March 14th at denvergov.org/affordabilityincentive. The Denver Planning Board and City Council are expected to debate and vote on the new policy this spring. If adopted, city officials anticipate it will take effect in time to shape all projects submitted for review after June 30th of this year. Denver had an inclusionary housing ordinance that was in effect from 2001 to 2016, but it applied only to for-sale projects of 30 or more units. The new proposal is much wider-reaching in the face of a worsening crisis. 1 in 3 households in Denver struggles with housing costs, and 46,000 are paying more than half their incomes toward housing. Britta Fisher, executive director of the Denver Department of Housing Stability, said in a statement Wednesday, "These are our restaurant workers, child care providers, and social workers, the people who make our city run. This proposal helps ensure they can not only work here, but can afford to live here, too." Denver protests, officers suspended for excessive force, by Lee Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Two Denver police officers will serve unpaid suspensions for using excessive force on demonstrators during two separate protests in 2020. Officer Jesse Trudel twice used pepper spray on people peacefully protesting the murder of George Floyd on May 29, 2020, according to a Denver Department of Public Safety disciplinary letter. Trudel did not give orders to the people he sprayed before using the pepper spray, and body camera video showed the people he targeted were not posing any threat, the letter states. Trudel's body camera footage recorded him saying, "I'm going to fog this expletive deleted," before spraying a woman in the face, even though she had her arms down and wasn't acting aggressively, the letter states. Officer Trudel's comment prior to deploying the OC spray demonstrates that Officer Trudel targeted this individual with OC spray out of frustration rather than out of a justifiable need to deploy a chemical agent, Chief Deputy Director of Public Safety Mary Delacky wrote in a letter, referring to oleoresin capsaicin, or pepper spray. "This deployment was not used to prevent injury against an individual interfering with or resisting arrest, or to quell rioting or disperse an unlawful crowd." Trudel told internal affairs investigators that he used his pepper spray because there were several explosions near his feet and head, and he couldn't tell where the threats were coming from. He said he used his pepper spray in the direction of the explosion to disperse the crowd, which he said was becoming more aggressive. According to the letter, Trudeau said it was the first time he was in a large-scale riot and that the 4 to 8 hours of crowd control training in the academy was nowhere near sufficient. Trudeau joined the department in 2018. He stated that he has never felt greater fear for his personal safety or the safety of other officers than on the first night of the riots, the letter states. He stated that he is unsure if any amount of training could prepare someone for the type of aggression used against the officers that night. Trudeau is the third Denver police officer to be disciplined for using excessive force during the protests of Floyd's murder in May and June of 2020. Another officer, Daniel Veith, will serve a 5-day unpaid suspension for using his baton to hit a person who is protesting the forced removal of an encampment of people experiencing homelessness on August 19, 2020. Veith said he hit the person after the person tried to grab his baton and took a swipe at him. But video showed that Veith hit the person, whose gender is not identified in the letter, before the person made any move toward him, according to his disciplinary letter. Veith told investigators that the scene was chaotic and he felt that the officers at the cleanup were on their own with no supervisors to create a plan. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.